any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll learn about degree programs offered by the National Labor College with NLC's Gene Dearden. We'll also discuss efforts to preserve Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid with Democracy for America Chair Jim Dean and sequestration's impact on veterans with AFGE VA Local 1843 representatives Kelvin Flannery and Betty Conlon. But first, we've been joined by AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel. Dale, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason. Good to be here.
Dale, AFGE and the council are mourning the loss of Eric Williams, a correctional officer killed in the line of duty in February at the United States Penitentiary Canaan in northeastern Pennsylvania. Can you tell me what happened here?
Jason, he was doing his job. He was trying to prepare for the count, trying to secure the unit, and since 2005, when mission critical, he was alone. We used to have two officers in the unit in those institutions. So he was alone, and he was, as he walked up the steps, from what I understand, to go to the second level, he was attacked, and he had no opportunity to do anything. I think he was hit so hard that he fell back down the stairs and seemed like he was rendered kind of almost unconscious. And by that time, by the time he gathered himself, the inmate was on him, trying to stab him with a shank in the neck. And that attack continued. So he didn't have opportunity to hit his body alarm. He didn't have pepper spray, which now I think they're going to. Well, we actually agreed to modify the pilot program and put pepper spray in all of the highs, and we have entered into some discussions about putting it in some of our other institutions that we house these dangerous people in as well. There was no help, so he was just there. Injured to the point that he couldn't move, couldn't get up. The inmate kicked him, I think, in the head, and I think, according to the coroner, that's probably what actually killed him. He was alive. He was alive until the officer next in the unit next to him realized that he had broken routine. He would come over and meet him, and then they would work together to do the count. And he didn't come over, so he decided to go over and see what was the matter, and then he saw him there on the floor. So at that point, they began the attempt to rescue him and get him to a hospital or medical attention immediately, and they did, but I think the injuries were so terrible to the head, I think that's what that actually caused him to pass away. So minutes sometimes can save a life either way, before and after. But it's a tragic situation. He's the second officer we've had attacked since 2005, since the Jose Rivera murder in 2008.
Dale,
so it's devastating.
Dale, just a senseless, terrible tragedy here. One of the things that you mentioned that stood out to me is that Officer Williams was working alone, just as Officer Rivera was back in 2008 when he was killed, as you mentioned, at the USP Atwater in California. Talk to me about officers working alone in a federal prison.
Apparently, it's dangerous. Apparently, it's not as secure as we once thought it was. Prior to 2005, the agency, we were staffed at a level where we had two officers in these units. And so even without pepper spray, we had backup. Even with a body alarm, we had another person there with a body alarm. We had people, and there being two in each one, then you had at least one that could respond if there was trouble anyway. Now we're limited on who can respond anyway throughout the prison on any shift. You know, we gambled on it once, and we lost Jose, and then we continued that same gamble, and now we've lost two, and so now the agency is actually, the Attorney General has made a vow that he would make the prisons more safe. So we're hoping that he didn't specify, but we're trying to lean towards or guide them in the direction of putting those officers back in there. And they weren't mandated to be removed. The initiative did not mandate everyone, but the agency went ahead and took them out of those hives and out of the other institutions that we're looking to put the pepper spray in now. So hopefully we can get back to that. But then with this sequestration, we're already at a loss. We're already very low on our staffing, and now we're going to lose another 5% of our staff each and every day. So it's not mission critical anymore. It's a mission impossible.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Dale Desotel, the president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, you mentioned earlier in the immediate aftermath here of Officer Williams' death that the Bureau was going to expand its pepper spray pilot program. And for our listeners who might not be aware, of course, the program was rolled out in 7 facilities nationwide throughout the Bureau of Prisons. But now this program is going to be instituted at all United States penitentiaries throughout the Bureau. Is that correct?
That's correct. We modified the program the Wednesday or the Thursday that we were up there before the funeral, a day or two after the tragic incident, after he died. We extended that program to the highs and began the dialogue about trying to get it into other institutions that house these type people as well.
How about staffing levels in the immediate aftermath? Was any decision made on that?
There's a lot of discussion. We had some discussion yesterday on it, and we're going to continue those discussions today and throughout, where we can, in these institutions, reevaluate what we have, what posts we do have, and especially the housing units on these with one officer, to try to find someone that is the mission is less critical at certain times of the day and get those people in there for backup, especially when we close the doors with them. During the day watch, there are counselors and case managers and other administrative staff that are around, and that's what they base their decision on, that we do have other people there. But in the evening watch and, in the, after, 8 to 4, when people go home, we run a very small staff, because at a certain point of time we lock the prison down for the evening, and then morning watch it's we do counts and this maintain until 6 o'clock or so in the morning, or till we start releasing inmates to go to work. So yeah, those times are appear to be critical before we lock the institution down, before we lock the cells down.
Dale, clearly one officer in a housing unit where the officer might be responsible for up to 150 inmates at one time, clearly only one officer in there is dangerous. Now, without any specifics going forward about increased staffing, but with an increase in the pepper spray pilot program, are these things enough to keep your fellow officer safe on the job?
Well, it's better than what we have. I can't face another family and tell them we did everything that we could do if we don't do something else, if we don't do everything that we possibly can to make sure that we got some backup. Listen, I was in the riot in Oakdale, not in it, but I was employed there when the Cuban riot hit in 1987. We didn't have enough people in the town of Oakdale to sustain what happened. They took over the prison. That could happen any time, But on a normal operation, a normal day, to have that second officer in there, we've got another set of eyes, we've got another set of hands to use to investigate and to search and look for these weapons that these guys make. We've got another extra set of hands to pat search them to make sure they're not bringing in contraband. We've got an extra set of eyes and hands to help monitor the inmates of what they're up to, any kind of activity that may be suspect. It greatly enhances what we're trying to do. And keep in mind, these numbers, 150, we have housing units all over the country. They're up to 250, you know, in these lower security or medium security housing units. This was just a penitentiary. Not just a penitentiary, but these numbers are from that penitentiary. But keep in mind, and this is important, that we have institutions where there's 250 now behind this overcrowding in these medium institutions. And a lot of these people that go to the USPs come from a medium. they do something else. They kill another inmate, or they assault staff or what have you, which gives them a higher security level where they end up in the penitentiary. So, you know, it's dangerous all the way through, and it can go as high as 250 to 1. So you can see there's still danger there. You cannot monitor that many inmates with one person to begin with, you know. So it's not just – don't just get stuck on 150 to 1.
And Dale, all of this that you have explained to us here today has happened before – the impact of sequestration, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. We had an escape in Chicago. Two inmates escaped, armed and dangerous, is what the FBI said. That's before. That's what the staffing levels we have now, where they were having to pull staff and put them in other areas. And they gambled on one certain housing unit too many times. And apparently this had been, these inmates had been working on breaking through the wall. I'm sure it didn't happen overnight. When we don't have the staff to maintain control of these institutions, to maintain the security, to maintain the contraband level, to remove those threats of weapons as we shake down the areas in their bed, their cells and in their property, and just constantly supervise these people, they get through the cracks, and this is what happens. We have incidents, and now that we're not going to have, and even though we take staffing from administrative areas or other areas that actually do programming for inmates, those guys are not as experienced as the officers that work there every day. They're not going to know those inmates like the officer does. And so it's going to take a while for them to catch on, to do their job. Then with pay cuts and pay freezes and changing of shifts and what have you, it's going to disrupt everything. Everybody is going to be at each other's wit's end with this sequestration. So the stress level is going to go up, at a level beyond what people can already stand now. This is just insane.
Dale, quickly before we close out here, what's your next step, your next priority, top priority going forward?
We want to try to get the funding, try to get this sequestration stopped in its tracks. We want the funding. We need the staffing levels. We need the 8,000 beds that were shut down, that will be shut down behind this sequestration. We need the beds to put these people in because we get 6,000 a year. We've got to move forward. If this thing continues, we are going to be put so far back, I don't know that we'll ever recover.
Dale Desotel, the president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, we certainly appreciate your time today and extend our sincerest condolences to you and your members on the loss of your colleague.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about the National Labor College with Gene Dearden, the head of NLC's Bonnie Layden Union Skills Program.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Gene Dearden, the director of the Bonnie Layden Union Skills Program at the National Labor College. Gene, welcome.
Thank you, Jason.
Gene, start off by telling me a little bit about the National Labor College and its mission.
Okay, the National Labor College, it's the only college in the U.S. with an exclusive mission to serve the educational needs of the labor movement. And our student base is made up of labor activists, leaders, and staff who are adult learners who have all the responsibilities of adults, of a full-time job, working for their local, serving as a local officer or an activist, being involved with their family and their community or their church. And our program suits the needs of a really busy adult learner.
Gene, as you know, worker rights have been under attack at the state level, at the federal level, the local level for quite some time. It's been a tumultuous couple of years. Talk to me about why furthering one's education in the labor movement is valuable as much now as ever.
Well, getting education and training in labor topics such as arbitration, negotiations, grievance handling, union staff training methods, teaching techniques, I mean, all of these skills help you to further what we're all trying to do in the labor movement. We need a lot of specific skills, and then we also need a lot of more general leadership skills. And you can get this by taking the classes or programs that we offer at the National Labor College, and it will really help you to do what we're all trying to do in a much better, more strategic, organized way.
Gene, let's talk about some of the degree programs offered by the National Labor College.
Well, we have labor studies, union leadership and administration, labor education, labor safety and health, and then we have some new programs, business administration, of course, from a labor perspective, construction management, and emergency readiness and response management. And those three new programs are all taught from a labor perspective.
Let's talk about the process of becoming a student at the National Labor College. Is this something that would happen right out of high school, or are college credits required to apply?
It's best if you have a few college credits under your belt, but we also have a program that can help you gather together the credits you have through life experience. So our program is known as an upper division school, so it's like junior and senior year. But any credits that you have from, and there's some, you know, specific requirements, but most credits that you have from a college or university, we will transfer in, and they will count towards your degree. Also, we accept military training and other types of training, apprenticeship program training, and there are other types of specific training that we accept. And we have a program called the Prior Learning Assessment that helps you to put together your life experience and write it up in an equivalent way to the description of a college course so that you can receive credits for that experience.
I imagine that's pretty popular with the applicants for the National Labor College to be able to apply their own life experience toward this prior learning assessment program.
Absolutely. And you can use prior learning assessment can bring in up to 30 credits for a student. So it's a very valuable tool.
Gene, how about graduate courses? Are you offering graduate program courses to anyone?
We have, in conjunction with George Mason University, a program in organizational development. It's their program, but they have a specific program for a labor cohort that we help put together. So we have adult students who have a background in labor who go through and they take the classes together as a group.
Gene, there are a few courses here that I understand might be of particular interest to our AFGE members. The Labor Relations in the Federal Sector course, Arbitration Preparation and Presentation, and a certificate for arbitration and grievance handling. Can you go through the three of these in detail, why they may be so valuable to our AFGE members?
Yes, and first I wanted to say the certificate is in process now. Mm-hmm. We've sent a proposal to the Maryland Higher Education Commission, and they're looking at it now, so that'll be finalized most likely, you know, in the next 30 or 60 days or so. But what we have great arbitration classes. And since federal employees have a somewhat unusual grievance system, particularly involving discipline, the federal grievance system requires more writing than most and a good deal of analysis. And our arbitration classes are perfect for preparing people for this kind of advocacy. They're helpful for people who are actually doing arbitrations or preparing for arbitrations or stewards who are handling grievances. We don't use a federal sector case, but we show people how to really dig in and analyze a case to a degree that most students haven't experienced. So we have a series of arbitration classes that we offer here at the National Labor College, and many AFGE members have already taken them, and they actually requested the arbitration certificate. So that's when we went ahead and sent the proposal to the Maryland Higher Education Commission. We also have a class, Labor Relations in the Federal Sector, as you mentioned. It's coming up April 1st through 5th. And that is taught, it's taught by labor professionals in the federal sector, and it provides an overview of issues represented to or related to the representation of federal sector employees. And we include collective bargaining, contract enforcement, workers' comp, solidarity building, and it's geared specifically to the federal sector.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Gene Dearden, the director of the National Labor College's Bonnie Layden Union Skills Program. Gene, let's talk about the Union Skills Program that you head up, the Bonnie Layden Union Skills Program. Give me a sense for what it is and what you're out to accomplish.
The Bonnie Layden Union Skills Program, it's a hands-on program. So generally speaking, our programs are a week long, and there are people who are actively involved, leaders, staff, and activists, and they're week-long intensive courses, and we combine in-class instruction with real-life experiences. So people are taking the actual work they're doing out in the field and learning how to do it better, and then we have cases where they can apply what they're learning, or they can actually use the work that they're doing in the field and work on that more specifically and have a place to practice and show their work with others and share it with others who are doing the same thing and get feedback from their peers and also get feedback from our experienced instructors.
Gene, how many credits are available during this week-long course?
Most classes, generally speaking, are 2 credits. So labor relations in the federal sector is 2 credits.
Let's talk a little bit about the response that you have received overall about some of these courses at the National Labor College. Are you finding a lot of enthusiasm behind them?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we get great feedback because people are together with their peers, and also people talk about how our instructors are able to take something that's complex and allow students, people who are actively doing this work, to understand it more completely and be able to apply more specific skills.
Do you have a success story or two that you could share with me, maybe someone who's gone on from his or her education at the college to do great things in the labor movement?
There have actually been several people who have gone on to become elected officers in their local or moved up to a district office or who have gone on and done great things in their local by solving a lot of ULPs, unfair labor practices. There are a lot of stories out there where people have gone on and were able to really do work that they've been trying to do for a long time.
Gene, you specialize in the development and design of effective training and adult learning. How have you applied those elements into the Bonnie Layden Union Skills Program?
Yeah, my specific background is in curriculum development, instructional systems design for adult learners. So I use that experience and that training that I have to put together the programs. And I work with subject matter experts, our instructors, and we work together to put together the programs.
The National Labor College also has partnered with AFGE on what's called the JNS Labor Scholarship. Tell me about the scholarship, Gene.
That's an excellent scholarship. So AFG members, they're eligible to get up to $5,000 a year towards education and training at the National Labor College. So if they want to take a union skills class or a class in the BA programs, they can apply that scholarship money towards tuition and books.
Are there deadlines associated with this scholarship that our listeners could be aware of?
The AFGE scholarship has, it's a rolling deadline, but for federal financial aid, there are deadlines involved, and the next one that's coming up is actually April 8th.
And are there any credit requirements that one must have in advance of applying for the scholarship?
With the federal, through the federal government, you have to have 56 credits to receive financial aid.
And Gina, our listeners may or may not know, the National Labor College holds many of its courses online, but there are some face-to-face classes. Is that right?
That's right. The Bonnie Leading Union Skills Program, those classes are face-to-face, and we hold them at the MyTags Institute, the Maritime Institute, which is up near BWI Airport. And it's a great place. It's a union facility. It's completely union staffed, and union organizations have been using it for decades to hold classes and programs and conferences, and that's where we hold our classes. They have also have just, it's a great facility. They have a wonderful staff, a wonderful cafeteria, and a great education facility.
Gina, if our listeners would like to learn more about the National Labor College or perhaps apply for a scholarship that's available or sign up for a course, where can they find you online?
www.nlc.edu.
And is there anything that we missed here today about the college that you would like to add for us, Gene?
Absolutely. I actually have some breaking news for you that we just heard from the Middle States Commission on Higher Education, which is the assessment agency for our geographic area. We applied for the ability to have an associate's degree, and actually last night we were just approved by Middle States Commission on Higher Education, and it will be through the District of Columbia Higher Education Authority also, and the office for it will be located at the AFL-CIO. So beginning this fall, we're going to have an associate's degree, and we just found this out.
Gene Dearden, the director of the National Labor College's Bonnie Leading Union Skills Program. Gene, congratulations on that great news, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll address the need to preserve programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid with Democracy for America Chair Jim Dean.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, SeaWorld, and Universal Studios? And if you enjoy winter activities, take advantage of discount lift tickets for New England ski resorts. These are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. AFGE also offers members a host of other valuable benefits, from scholarships and insurance to discounts on computers, appliances, health clubs, and more. AFGE is the largest and most influential federal and D.C. government employee union in the United States. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Go to AFGE.org and click on the Join AFGE Today button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jim Dean, the chair of Democracy for America. Jim, welcome back.
Hey, Jason. It's great to be back. Thanks.
Jim, you have a lot on your plate these days. Let's start with your efforts to preserve some of these social programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. What's happening?
Well, we have been vociferous in our defense of all three of these programs. These are programs that all of us have been paying into all of our working lives. They are not entitlements. And frankly, if you're going to go after really every single American that is, has paid for these benefits, I think you've got a lot of other negotiating to do first in terms of solving a budget crisis or anything else. I mean, businesses, big business in particular, has been living high off the hog on the taxpayer's dime. The investment banking industry's risk is completely being covered by the taxpayer right now. There is no way that kind of stuff can continue and have us cut back on social insurance programs that Americans are not only paying for but need the most. So it really doesn't make any sense. It really shouldn't be thrown in with these budget discussions. It's presenting a lot of false choices that are just confusing things, and these programs should be allowed to stand on their own and, frankly, be strengthened.
Jim, I'm interested in something that you just said, and that is that these programs, in your assessment, are not entitlements, and of course something that all Americans have been paying into their entire working lives. Talk to me about your thought process on why these are not entitlements.
Well, you know, to me, this is like any insurance program. Although, unlike health insurance in the private sector, when you pay into a Social Security and Medicare, you're at least getting the benefits back, as the government has promised. And so, you know, I think the idea of calling this an entitlement is frankly offensive. I mean, to me, an entitlement is a bailout of an investment bank whose people get to keep their jobs and keep their outrageous salaries. That's an entitlement. An entitlement is a $4 billion federal subsidy to the oil industry that's making record profits. An entitlement is not a social insurance program that has already been paid for by the taxpayers. And the fact that just because Republicans in Congress have been trying to, you know, take money out of there, it doesn't mean that, you know, that this is something that we should be taking away from the American consumer just because they've run the program into the ground. These are good programs. They work if they're left alone. They have worked for a long time, and consumers should be getting the benefits because they paid for them.
Jim, talk to me about what these programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, mean for the recipients, many of whom are middle and low-income Americans.
Well, I mean, I can tell you some conversations I've had, Jason, that I find very interesting. You know, I've talked to some well-off people recently who were over the age of 65 or 70, and they said, you know, we would gladly pay, you know, do something more so that everybody can have Social Security benefits. But we are just like anybody else, and that we absolutely need Medicare benefits, for example. We can't get insurance unless we have it. So it is very true that these things are incredibly important for middle income and folks in poverty. This is money that all of which gets spent on these people because they need it for basic services and basic necessities. But even for people who are well off, you know, I mean, I hate to be sympathizing with Mitt Romney's crowd here, but the fact is, nobody can get health insurance if over the age of 65, and nobody would be able to get health insurance if it wasn't for Medicare. So everybody needs these programs, and middle-income and poor people need it more than anybody else.
Jim, ultimately, what are you expecting the outcome to be in this conversation as it relates to the budget battles on Capitol Hill?
Well, I'm very concerned, Jason, because, as you know, people are getting hurt right now by the sequestration, particularly federal employees, but also you know, a lot of people that are beneficiaries to many of these programs. And here we are with the prospect that the president may say, well, in order to end this, in order to get us back on track with funding these programs and get out of the sequestration, we have to give up something on Medicare and Social Security. That is a false choice, and we strongly urge the president not to take that move. And frankly, I wish he'd stop talking about it. I understand he wants to demonstrate his bona fides about being able to negotiate and make concessions. This is not the place to do it. You know, defense cuts we could talk about. We could talk about a lot of things, but you can't talk about Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. Again, these people have paid for these benefits, and we shouldn't be giving those benefits up in the interest of satisfying a false choice on the budget that's being proffered by the Republicans in Congress. So I really hope it doesn't go in that direction. If it does, I'm not so sure it's going to fly in the rest of the Congress. I mean, even Republican senators aren't going to necessarily vote to cut Medicare and Social Security. Many of them represent states with an older demographic. You know, I hope we'll get rid of that discussion fairly soon.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Jim Dean, the chair of Democracy for America. Jim, as you mentioned, sequestration has kicked in with federal agencies implementing across-the-board budget cuts and federal employees looking at mandatory furloughs. With your knowledge of the federal government, Jim, what's the danger here of sequestration?
Well, first of all, there's a danger that's been going on for way too long. I personally am really, really fed up with it. And that is this meme where it's always blame the employees every time something goes wrong. Now, we have seen this, of course, in the private sector for a number of years. where companies whose stocks go down a little bit or miss Wall Street expectations lay off 5,000 or 6,000 people at a clip just so they can, you know, chief executives can keep their salaries. We've seen this actually now in the public sector with people like Governor Chris Christie, by the way, whose numbers are not going to be nearly as good pretty soon as everybody thinks they are right now, because he, in fact, has made his living off of blaming hardworking people like teachers. I think, you know, look, you could talk about programs that need to be cut or need to be changed. I think that's a legitimate discussion. But you've got a situation right now where, you know, we aren't wildly paying federal employees. Many of these folks don't get Social Security benefits and other benefits like that. We are, in fact, really need to treat these people and treat these folks like this as the solution to making government work. Frankly, these folks, federal employees, but also state and municipal employees, are doing a far better job than a lot of the private sector folks are. You ask people how they're satisfied with Medicare, you're going to get a high satisfaction rating. You ask people how well they're satisfied with their health insurance, private health insurance thing, it's almost at the opposite end of the scale. And that's because of the employees that are working this thing and the customer satisfaction. So we need to have a very different conversation about who's really at fault in this. And what I think we would find if we did have that conversation is that who is at fault were a lot of people in Congress, both on both sides of the aisle, that have frankly been giving it up taxpayer-owned assets to private constituents and private businesses. And that's what's been raiding the budget. And if we get rid of that, then we can start having a discussion, maybe, on layoffs. But I think if we were to get rid of that kind of corruption, we wouldn't be having that discussion at all because it wouldn't be necessary.
Jim, how concerned are you as just a regular, everyday American that pretty soon public services coming from the federal government are going to take a hit, in addition to middle-class Americans, federal employees being made to take mandatory furlough days?
I am very concerned about it, I actually believe that it is. We are going down this track right now, and I don't see any way out. In part because of the opposition. I mean, the Republicans can stop this, can stop the wheels from turning in the federal government, and they're being successful at it. They have no incentive, or they don't think they have an incentive. For us to get out of this. And but I do think there is an end game here, and it may be ugly, Jason. I think you're going to be looking at some services that are going to be cut, already are being cut, and the people are going to be very, very upset. The voters and taxpayers are going to be very upset. I don't think it's going to take very long. They'll be upset at Washington, but it's going to be pretty clear pretty soon. They're going to be upset at the people who started this, which is the Republicans in Congress. And, you know, out of something like that, as horrible as it might get for both the employees, but as well as the beneficiaries whom the employees have been taking care of and everything, we may get an inflection point that finally, where people finally say, enough is enough. It's not the government's fault. It never was the government's fault. Enough is enough. It's not the employees' fault, because it never was. And we really are in this together, and we really expect these people to govern, and we're done with this. And, you know, we haven't gotten to that point yet, but I think we're mighty close. And that might yield actually a much better environment afterwards, but I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, Jason.
Jim, your organization, Democracy for America, has always been very active at the state level, as you were involved in the labor battles in states like Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and others. What's happening there in these states these days?
Well, I think there's a lot going on. I was just in Michigan about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I was just in Pennsylvania last weekend. And, you know, it's funny, you know, our membership is not really out of labor. I mean, I've never actually belonged to a labor union. I think this is a situation where you've got a lot of folks who have long understood that if you work for a living in this country, you ought to be able to make a living. And what we've seen in terms of the excessive behavior of the governance in Wisconsin and in Michigan and in Ohio and Pennsylvania is a bridge too far for a lot of folks, which is why our members really got us into the Wisconsin thing, and we really were pleased to work with labor and would go back there in 5 seconds, and will, and at the next point that we have, next opportunity. You know, we want to get something going in Michigan. We're obviously not big enough to go in and and run the whole thing or anything like that. But there's a lot of good folks in labor and in progressive groups who are working together, and that's really important because I was in the room with all of them, and they're on the same page. I think we want a permanent field program there, and if we can start that soon, DFA can certainly add to that, and the end game being that we're going to have a legislature and especially a governor that actually represents the state instead of doing whatever the hell they want. So, you know, we have that opportunity. I think Pennsylvania is a great opportunity next year to change the legislature and the governorship. We have at least two great Democratic candidates, very, very capable people running for governor and very good legislative candidates. So, being in these states, it's important. It's important for labor, but it's important for everybody because changing this is what I think is really going to change the economic environment of this. You know, we need governors who want to foster talent, technology, and tolerance instead of governors who just want to cut and leave everybody out in the street, as we're seeing in Michigan, as we've seen in Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Jim Dean, the chair of Democracy for America. Jim, always a great time having you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on, Jason. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the impact sequestration would have on veterans with AFGE VA Local 1843 representatives Kelvin Flannery and Betty Conlon.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program. It offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program is administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office. It's handled more than 700 cases since 2005 and won millions of dollars in back pay for its members. In each of the last 2 years alone, AFGE attorneys have brought in more than $1 million in attorney's fees. Their attorneys are experienced litigators and committed to the best possible representation. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit Systems Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For more information about the program, please call 202-639-6424. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by two representatives from VA Local 1843. We have Kelvin Flannery, the president, and Betty Conlon, the treasurer and steward. Kelvin and Betty, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sitting here today at AFGE's Legislative Conference, tell me what you've seen so far.
I see a lot of people with very large hearts to try to succeed in what's going on in D.C. with the Congress, certain aspects of the Congress and the Senate, them trying to stand up for the rights of their rank-and-file members, as well as VA employees and other sections. I also see that people are joining our local in droves.
That's true. They're really disgusted about what's going on with our government. We live in New York, and everything is going up except our salaries, and it's very hard to live.
What's that impact on your day-to-day lives?
It's extremely hard. We haven't had a cost of living in 4 years, and our insurance has gone up. Our gas has gone up back and forth to work, and we've been hit by Sandy, and it just everything is piling up on us, and people are getting fed up with the way we're being treated. Because if it wasn't for the federal workers, there would be nothing going on. I mean, they're hiring contractors who are getting paid unbelievable amounts of money, and they're taking away government jobs from the people that have been there for years. And if people retire, they don't fill the place. And if they do, they lower the grade for the employee.
Do the residents of Northport, New York, the people in your surrounding communities, understand the value that you provide as public servants, as federal employees?
The people in the general area, yes. Because without the VA being in that section, I think they're infrastructure in Northport would suffer because the amount of employees that utilize small shops, restaurants in that area would definitely feel the impact. If the VA wasn't there, it would definitely make it harder for them.
Talk to me a little bit about your VA facility. What challenges do you have there at the workplace?
We have a lot of challenges because our local took it upon ourselves to get from the rank and file membership the approval to expend $2,000 out of our budget to help veterans, homeless veterans, veterans coming back, their families, setting up food pantries. We tried to set up a food pantry on the VA site, and basically we extended our hand and basically got it slapped back in our face because all we did was run into walls. Now, this is not for, you know, rank and file membership, and it's not for VA employees. It's to help our veterans coming back, to assist them because of the job market is so hard for them that they need a helping hand. They do have families they have to support, and we figured that this would be the best way to try to make the union look less as an adversary, to show that we do have a heart. And basically what we ended up doing was going out to an outside food pantry to try to get them to give us a hand to help us support them. The idea was put forth to the director, and we were directed to the Chief of Social Work to try to set up a food pantry on site at Northwood, and basically just ran into walls. Also, we started a scholarship program for our membership because people don't have the money anymore to go back to school. So we this past year rewarded two $1,000 scholarships for our membership to assist in that. So it's more than just fighting with management, locking horns. We're trying to show that, yeah, we're a local, but we do have a heart and we really care about what we're into.
It sounds like the local really is involved deeply in the community.
Yes, we do a lot for the community, and I don't know if Kelvin didn't tell you that, but he got together with nursing management to get them together now to start classes for upper mobility. And Northport will pay for people willing to go to school to become RNs that are working there. And they will start classes on the facility, which they haven't done in years. And working together with the union, it's going to come true now. So it's really working well, and it helps a lot of people in the community, too. We have a lot of people that spend time on their own with food drives and everything else for our veterans, because a lot of them are coming back from Iraq, and I don't think the government realized all the problems that come with them coming back, with their homes and the housing and the PTSD that they're going through. It's very sad, and our government needs to step up to the plate.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with two representatives from AFGE's VA Local 1843, Kelvin Flannery, the president, and Betty Conlon, the treasurer and a steward. Kelvin and Betty, talk to me a little bit about the challenges that a war veteran faces transitioning back into civilian life after battle.
Well, Betty could talk more about that because her son just came back. He is a Marine, and she could probably address that better than I.
Both my sons are Marines, and both of them have been in Iraq, and my son-in-law is in the Navy and was in Iraq. And I don't think there's a lot of things that are going on for the veterans when they come back. I mean, they're at war, and they're fighting, and they need to be able to speak with people about the problems that they're having. And the transition is not working that well because we have so many patients now with PTSD. I'd say 90% of the people coming back have a form of PTSD. I don't believe medication is going to solve everything. They need to be able to have more outlet for them to take care of it because it's very hard for them. You know, when you come from war and you're fighting and killing people and then come back to civilization, like loud sounds make them go off. It's just very sad, and I think our government needs to do more and have more active participation with people involved in what's going on.
One of the things that our national president, J. David Cox, has said many times on this program is that the human brain is not equipped to deal with some of the things that are seen and experienced on the battlefield. Kelvin, would you agree with that?
Yeah, this is the last two wars that we have. It's completely different than the wars we had in the past. In the past, there was always a front line. In Vietnam, it was a DMZ. But you always had a place you could go back to where you felt safe, that you could have a little R&R and get away from rigors of war. In Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't have that. They can go back to their base, and the enemy is lobbing bombs, missiles into their mess tents. So the whole thing is they are on the front line 24/7. Plus the extension of the time served is a great deal. I mean, they just keep on extending the time that you serve over there. They have multiple recalls. some of them three, four, five times being called back for a longer duration of time, that it will play upon your psyche at that point. It's a completely different atmosphere. The VA is trying to keep up to step with it, but when you have people coming back looking to gain entrance into the system and they have to wait 4 months for their first appointment, that is not really helping the veterans. It makes it like, well, someday we'll call you back, and it's only because of the lack of staffing, the lack of quality employees. We have a lot of interns, a lot of residents. We have a lot of contract employees that help direct patient care, that they don't really have the background to address the needs of the veterans.
As you prepare to make your way up to Capitol Hill to speak with your representatives, what message will you be taking to them?
Well, I will be bringing forth that the pay freeze, they need to look at the total picture. Sure, you freeze salaries for 3 years, but at that same period of time, your health insurance premiums have gone up greatly. So at this point, the federal employees are working at a deficit because of the cost of living not going up, everything from gas to milk, eggs, all this stuff is going up in their day-to-day life, and they are really fighting to keep their heads above water. I know a lot of VA employees that are looking for government assistance to make ends meet. They have children. They do have a daycare center at the VA in Northport, but it's pricey. It is definitely pricey.
I think that they should know also about there should be more training for management to deal with the veterans coming back, because some of them don't have a clue what's going on. And I'm sure a lot of the veterans feel like when they're there that they're treated less than a normal citizen, that, you know, they like they're being tolerated with, and that's not fair. And other employees treat them fabulous, but there are some that need to be trained more, and that causes a problem.
As we look ahead through the rest of 2013 and beyond, what will your top priorities be?
My top priorities are basically, number one is definitely the veterans coming back. That's a big concern for me. They need the best care that we can afford them. If they contract nursing out, if they contract other services to private companies, they are not properly trained and qualified to deal with the particular situations that are occurring at, you know, for the veterans, and especially at Northport. It needs to be said that they need to increase. We are constantly being told that they have to lose more FTEs, full-time employees, and we're working with a skeleton crew now. The end result is you'll get more contractors coming on site to do what traditionally the VA employees used to do.
They expect the employees to do twice as much work and cover for the staff that either retired or out of disability, and they're not replacing any of the employees that are coming in. And if they do replace them, they're putting them at a lower grade. So if somebody retired at a grade 6, they'll bring them in as a grade 5, doing just as much work. The pay scale is not equal. Pay grades are not equal, and that causes a lot of problems.
AFGE VA Local 1843, President Kelvin Flannery, and Treasurer Betty Conlon. Kelvin and Betty, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel, Gene Dearden of the National Labor College, Democracy for America Chair Jim Dean, and AFGE VA Local 1843 representatives Kelvin Flannery and Betty Conlon. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2.